Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today we welcome the CEO of Red Rock Resources, that's RRR, and that is Andrew Bell. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty well.
Good, good. And Kenny, are you pretty well?
Yep, I'm all good. I'm looking at the sort of last rays of sunshine up in Scotland since we get the darkness a bit earlier. The news guys down south.
We got a bit of sun today. It wasn't too bad today, but I do feel that now that summer's going, working from home or working a lot from home is beginning to get a little bit tedious.
Yeah. It's definitely half an hour here. It'll be starting to get dark. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's the nights have gone in quickly. But anyway, no, it's great to have you on, Andrew. When we first started these podcasts, you know, I had a top five people that I thought would want on these podcasts first. Your name would be on that list. But for some reason, we've avoided you for the first 70-odd. So it's good to get a hold of you. And
okay, so that puts me firmly down in the second division.
Well, no, it just never happened. We never chased you down. You were always jumping from country to country. Are you actually in the UK at the moment, Andrew?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, oh well, good, good. So you probably know the format by now, Andrew. We like to get the chairman, CEOs, directors, whatever, on. And we like to spend a bit of time on you know, what you've done. Not so much in your business and a career life, but more, you know, you can go back as far as you want. You can talk about your childhood, your education, your family, where you were brought up, just to get a bit of perspective about your life. So really, it's a bit of an open forum, and we'll try and steer you in the right path.
Okay.
And keep you on point.
I haven't heard one of these things before. And
all right.
British people are very bad about talking about themselves. So you may need to prompt me a little.
Yeah, I've got taser ready, Andrew, so I have.
Only kidding.
But so like I say, it's just an open forum for you to just tell us a bit about yourself, because we believe that people, and as well as investing in projects and the company, they want to know a bit about the person behind the company, because people make companies.
They do, and also to a greater extent than perhaps we realize, we're not just the children of our deeds, but we're the children of our parents and what they've been through and their experiences and so on too. We are influenced by those who brought us up in ways we're perhaps unconscious of and become more conscious of later in life.
So yeah, perhaps, you definitely end up on that. I'm sounding like my dad more and more every day. So I do. You used to look at your parents when you're younger and say, he's an absolute idiot. I'm never going to turn out like him. And lo and behold, 40 years later, I'm doing the exact same as him. But, okay, you mentioned your family, Andrew, so it might be a good place to start. Maybe take us back to your earlier childhood, where you were born.
Well, Kenny, since I'm talking to a fellow Scotsman, I'm going to start in Scotland.
Good stuff.
Yeah, my father's family were from the West Coast. The Macmillans and Bells and McCallums and McConaughey's, but I suppose I'm a Macmillan. And they came from Knapdale. My father's family came from Knapdale. But like a lot of people, they went down to Cardiff at some point because the Marquess of Bute owned a lot of land down there. And when he wanted to develop the Cardiff docks, for example, he knew that Scottish people were very well educated, so he brought down a lot of engineers and people who then remained there and formed a community. And one of my ancestors, I believe, designed Cardiff West Docks, and his brother designed the one of the docks in Docklands. And with Cardiff West Docks were designed, the exports in the next 10 years of coal from Wales went up 100 times. Because it had a very high tidal rise and fall, so it was a challenge. So my father was born in Cardiff, but very much feeling and thinking of himself as Scottish. as they all did, and there was a Presbyterian church. In fact, I think I heard from my father's elder brother, my uncle, that they used to be taken to church three times on a Sunday, from which you can imagine that they were fairly sort of serious fringe Presbyterian, something that I think my father probably reacted against slightly, although it gives one probably that background, Presbyterianism, gives one that appreciation for the spoken word, for learning, for taking things seriously, and so, which probably forms part, a certain Puritanism, which probably forms part of one's heritage. And when I wouldn't have described myself as identifying in that in any way when I was younger, but more and more I find probably I do identify it with a little, with it a little. For example, I've never knowingly been in the presence of people taking drugs, even at dinner parties and things, because probably they knew that if they did, I would make a fuss about it because it was illegal. So probably there's something in me that comes out from that side. And suddenly my father then became a member of parliament and a barrister. And his brother, his elder brother, was a mining engineer and was working in the coal industry. He was in the Tangshan mine before the war in China, which was the one where they had the big earthquake and lots of people died. During the war, he built airfields in India, the engineers. And afterwards, he worked in the mining industry, the coal industry in this country, and ended up as the president of the South Wales Institute of Mining Engineers. So that was very much a mining background. Mm-hmm. And my aunt, I don't know what she was doing out there, but she was interned during the war by the Japanese in Singapore. So she had an unfortunate experience of them. And when I found myself investing as an investment manager in Japan when I was younger, I was conscious that neither my uncle nor my aunt particularly approved. So that was my father's side of the family. Definitely Scottish, through and through. Probably 100%, because they've all got these Scottish names going back generations and generations. And on my mother's side, it's a little bit different because her maiden name was German, because one of her ancestors in the 19th century had come to this country and was involved with Johnson Camel and Company, which became Camel Laird. And Charles Camel married one sister and he married the other. And he had a business called Otto Gossel, which went through three generations and closed just really with the war. And they had a business just near where the old Hanseatic League stockyards were in Fenchurch Street, and were dealing in steel products and various other things with Germany. And my grandfather, my mother's father, still had sufficient of the German contact that after doing his first degree at Oxford, he went and did a degree at a German university. And of course, having been, although he fought for the British in the First World War and got a military cross, but when the Second World War came, I think, you know, anyone with a German surname was subject to suspicion from the local people in the villages and so on, more so, I think, than in the First War. And so all the knowledge really about the German side of the family kind of died out, because my grandfather on that side died young from some smoking, as many people did in those days. And his sisters, who were a series of maiden aunts, would never talk about anything to do with Germany. The rest of my mother's family were English. And I grew up sort of thinking that on my father's side, my father was member of parliament, a lawyer. On my mother's side, there were lawyers, clergymen, and so on, all over the place. And so I thought that was sort of basically my background. Then I discover, you know, that on my father's side, well, one of my direct ancestors was actually born in a tent at the gold diggings in Bendigo, obviously found some money in that time in the early 1850s, found some gold, came back, then went out a second time and has presumably found some again. But the story is that apparently he then lost it in some ship repair business back in Wales. And then on my mother's side of the family also, her father had invested in various German inventions they brought into this company, including miners' lamps, which they had manufactured by a company called Premier Lamp in Leeds. And one of my colleagues, a non-exec director of Red Rock, came in one day and said, you know, this was what I used when I first started work. And it was made by Premier Lamp and Engineering of Leeds. Mm. So I find that you scratch the surface and you have these people involved in industrial activities, the industrial history of this country, and in mining specifically, on both sides of the family. It just depends where you focus. My sister, who does a lot more work on this kind of thing, looking at ancestry, has got to the stage where, having discovered anyone remotely interesting in one's ancestry, everyone she discovers now is either a clog maker or a shoemaker or something, or a crofter. You find out the distinguished ones first.
Yeah.
Then you find out everything else. But it's interesting to find that almost everyone, I think, in this country, you look back a bit and you can find connections, people who went to Australia or were in Australia or Canada or somewhere, people who were involved in the Industrial Revolution some way or another. And I find that I can identify with that. I grew up having probably an education in humanities, did my degree in history. Here I am dealing with mining. I got a law degree in my spare time a few years ago. Then I got a half geology degree before I became too busy. But I probably wasn't really interested in mathematical things and numbers when I was young. But now I find myself more and more into numbers and fascinated by them and looking at data. And does one change? I think perhaps one does. Or was it some part of one's personality or one's ancestry that was always there that just comes out?
Maybe you're counting all your money, Andrew. That must be what it is.
I don't know. Yeah. So anyway, you gave me an opening and I gave you the quick ancestry.com.
Yeah, it's always interesting to look back. I must admit, there's a member of my family that does all the ancestry, and I've got a few framed photographs with all the, you know, going back a couple of generations. Yeah. It's quite interesting, but it seems to be when people retire, they seem to get more interested in things like this. It doesn't really appeal to me at the moment, but there may well come a time.
My father always claimed, rightly or wrongly, that when he travelled before the war, you'd go to these European countries, they'd have these absurd long forms you had to fill in when you entered them sometimes. Mm. And he once had one that said purpose of visit, and he put espionage. And it said any famous relations, he put Adam. And nobody ever read these things, so it didn't matter.
Yeah. It's interesting looking at your past. I'm sure there's a few rogues in everybody's past as well. All right, so you've kind of covered, you know, your family upbringing. You got a degree in history. What university was that at, Andrew, and where?
That was at Oxford.
That was at Oxford. What kind of experience was that like?
It was interesting. I mean, I had... my special subject was Byzantium in the age of Constantine Porphyrogenitus, which was actually looking at 9th and 10th century Byzantium and its neighbors, the art of that time and the theological debates. Everything. It was a very interesting period. And you were also, if you looked at it slightly broader, you were getting the rise of and the pressure from the east, from various Turkic tribes on the Eastern Empire. So I found that really interesting. And it has some, it helps one perhaps understand the Russia and Eastern Europe, whose inheritance in many ways is from Byzantium, rather than here it's from Rome.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre you say that, because I actually worked in Hungary for a month. Oh, I'm going back about 20 years now. And there was quite a few different cultures in Hungary. And it was only when a local explained to me, Hungary was probably the furthest extent that Genghis Khan got in his conquests. And a lot of people were descendants from Genghis Khan.
You are absolutely right. Hungary was the westernmost extension of the Eurasian steppe. And so every group of invaders, nomads that came off the steppe, would go into Hungary. The Avars, the Tatars, eventually the Magyars, who were the last ones who settled there. But they would come in. And the steppe had this amazing... Because people weren't settled in communities then, roaming over it, it had what someone described as this conductivity, in that if some disturbance happened in northern China and people got pushed onto the steppe, like a whole lot of billiard balls, they'd bounce all the way along and people would shoot off the western end into Europe or whatever, or invaders would come. And the invaders, when they came past Iran, if Iran was stable, they would come to Europe. If Iran wasn't stable, they would go south into India because that was always the richest area to go. But because in northern Iran, you could actually have cavalry because they had alfalfa. So horses weren't competing with humans for grain at a time when productivity of one grain sown was very low. The Iranians were able to keep a standing cavalry, which enabled them to repel quite often the nomads. Whereas in Western Europe, until the coming of feudalism, there was really no cavalry that could withstand them. So they came in. But the 15th century that the Magyars settled Hungary. And so the Alföld, the Hungarian plain, is actually an extension of the Eurasian steppe.
Yeah, I must admit, I mean, I got a history higher at school as well. I've done very well on it, so it's something that really interests me. So I suppose my next question is, Andrew, how do you get becoming an expert in the 9th and 10th century, the investment banking? Where did that leap come from?
Did I become an investment banker? It was a fairly conventional thing to do, wasn't it? because... They offered me a job, I suppose, and it was well paid. Because when I left university, we were only 1 year after the biggest recession ever, when the stock market had gone down to 150. And there were jobs available, but it wasn't probably the easiest thing. And there was some well-paid... what was well-paid at that time? I tell you what was well-paid then. Working for an overseas trader, like Swires or... Johnson or Jardine Matheson. Those were some really well-paid jobs. And then investment banks came just after. Mm-hmm. So I tried to get into a merchant bank. I had an interview at one of them, which was Warburg's, and I thought I was doing really well. And they sent off a sample of my handwriting, which they did with everybody, to some graphologist in Vienna. And when the sample came back, I didn't hear anything more. Yeah. And then I was interviewed by Morgan Granville. And there was someone hammering. There was having some repairs done in the office just above. So it was hammering on the just above the roof while I was having this interview. I thought that went terribly, terribly. That was awful. And they offered me a job. So I got into the city.
Right. And that was the name of the company there, was that Morgan?
Morgan Granville, that later got taken over by Deutsche Bank when the merchant banks, as they were called, got taken over by big banks, which then ruined them.
Mm. Yeah, and what was the role in there, Andrew? Was it a resource analyst? Was that your kind of...
Curiously, that's how I got into resources, because I joined the investment department, and with a degree in history, you'd think that I would not be oil and mining analyst. But the guy who was looking at that part of the market, which is quite a big part of the market, who was ex-Shell, had left the day before. So they slotted me into that. At various times, I was looking at 30% of the UK market while I was working that department. but what was constant was oil and mining. So I learned about it at the age of 21. And at that time, your mind is like a sponge. You can take things in. So I learned a lot in a couple of years. Of course, when I look back at my analysis then, I think I used to believe what company management's told me. I must have been mad, because now I know how far from the truth, not always because they intended to be far from the truth, but I can see that I was very uncritical in my acceptance of what I was told.
Okay. Yeah, sometimes when you're a rabbit in the headlights, I've been there myself, you just everything is told to you, you just believe, because you don't know any better sometimes.
No.
And you're old enough and I'm old enough to, we didn't have internet in those days, Andrew, so you couldn't go and check up on something that somebody told you.
Yes, that is true. I've become much more inclined to check things for myself and not to take them on trust. But of course, I was, I suppose, as the eldest child of my family, I was always slightly in awe of my elders, presumably betters. You joined somewhere and you were 21 years old and you were talking to chairman of some quite large company or the managing director, and you're inclined to take a lot of what they said on trust. Of course, if I've been the youngest in the family never has any respect for age at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm the youngest out of four.
Yeah.
It's very true. Yeah, my sister would attest to that as well.
Yeah. So that must have been quite a career then, Andrew, that you had. So you started that job in the 70s, and I mean, Red Rock and Regency never came around to about 2005. And we'll get on to them, but I mean, that's almost 30 years in that game. What companies did you work for in that time scale?
Yeah, it is true. So I did that. I then got into investment management, which was very interesting. I ran a unit trust, a Far Eastern unit trust, for what was then Greaves and Grant. Got taken over by Kleinwort, and then got taken over by Dresdner Bank. Sad, they all got, all the companies I work for, the names have disappeared because they got taken over by, respectively, Deutsche Bank, Dresdner Bank, UBS. So the names just went. Mm-hmm. And I think a large part of the businesses just went too, because I don't think those big banks were good at running really intelligent investment banking.
Yes, yeah, almost
what the merchant banks were. Yeah.
Boutique.
Yeah. They weren't good at running boutique stuff, which London had been really good at, kind of, you might almost say, bespoke financial services.
Yeah, that's probably a better word to describe it. Yeah. 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 So, yeah, like I say, you've done that for 30 years. So,
I did, you know, because if you actually talk about 30 years, you have to look back to the last 15 to 20. And so that's when I got into the resource space. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason was that in the late 70s, if you take 76 to 79, it was actually a little bit of a mining boom. The copper price and things didn't go up so much, but the gold price went up to $900. And it was a peak. And then it, after having peaked in 1979, it came down to about 300 quite quickly. And you look at that sort of early 80s, right up to the early 2000s, you had copper at sort of $600 to $800, really dead, almost flat. You had gold pretty flat, flapping around $300 an ounce. Sometimes it went up to 400, always came back down again. So there was, it was not a good time for the mining sector. And what I saw in the early 2000s is, because I was involved with the Far East, having run Far East Unit Trust, invested in Far East, I realized that the growth of China, and which was having, you could say 40%, the way I put it at the time was 40% of the world's population was having an industrial revolution. And the principal countries there, of course, are China, then some way behind, because it perhaps hasn't grown quite as fast in the early years as I expected, was India, but also companies like Thailand. They had They were following in the footsteps of Japan. And as they did so, the demand for raw materials was going to increase. And indeed, it did increase. And so that meant that from starting with, I think, nickel in 2003-04, and or moving on to the other metals in 2004-05, everything started to go up. That was the industrial metals first. And then once you got to the end of the 2000s, all that additional wealth in those countries was feeding through into demand for gold as well. And that made sense because the Indians always liked gold if they had a bit of money. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese were for the first time starting to be allowed to invest in gold. And so gold went to a new peak, then eventually of about 1800, 1800 in 2010-11. When I put a range of 2 years like that, because I can't remember which one it was, then it came back down to 1100, as we know, and then up again now to go through the all-time highs, first in other currencies and now in the dollar. Yes. So, so half of that time or more was actually spent. When I looked and I thought, hang on, I know a bit about the Far East and I know a bit about commodities because I've been through a cycle before. Now there's a new cycle beginning because the Far East is causing a new super cycle in commodities. And so I should really get into it, because if you see something come around a second time in your life, then you should recognize that this is the 9-10 for Manchester. Hop on. This is a train I recognized.
And what was that? What was the cycle like, Andrew? The one you experienced?
Well, of course, the thing about these cycles is they're choppy, because you get into them and you have to explore. And that means you're continually raising money to bring something from the point of discovery to the point of production. And if you're not well capitalized or if you don't have revenues, it's very easy for the shareholders' equity to be wiped out by having to raise money when the market is low. In a way, the oil business is easier, because when you drill a hole and you discover oil, you can use that hole to produce from. So that it may be expensive to find oil, but once you've found it, getting it into production can be very much quicker. When you find a mineral resource, that's just the beginning of what can be a long story.
Of course. So, and how many cycles you've seen? You say two. So when's the third one?
Third what?
Cycle.
Well,
some would say it's now, you see.
I think the third cycle is actually beginning now.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What signs make you think that from your past experience?
Well, first of all, people maybe haven't noticed, but in China, the iron ore steel production is running at record levels, higher than it was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Although the commodities index, when I last looked, was not in a bull market. If you look at the metals index, metals does look as if it's in a bull market. And I think that we've seen how quickly China has recovered from this virus. And that's going to be true of a number of companies and countries. And I think that the effect of the virus will actually pass quite quickly and recovery will be very fast. Some countries have done themselves an inordinate amount of self-inflicted harm. Of course, this one being a prime example. But that doesn't mean world growth is going to doesn't mean that world growth is going to come to an end. What I think was we may have injected a certain amount of inflation into the system, but the growth will be there.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, what happens over the coming months and probably days with some of the announcements that are coming out daily from the various press conferences of the various countries in the UK, which are all over the place. But I just want to drag you back to Red Rock and Regency. And just correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew. So Regency was born first and Red Rock was spun out of Regency. Is that correct?
This is true. Regency was doing base metals in Australia, nickel and copper. And within a few months, there were some iron ore and manganese projects that came along. And they looked very different in their type. And because Regency was a very small company, didn't seem advisable to have them in the same company. So we split it out into a new company. And the reason for that was, when you're talking about iron ore and manganese, you're talking about things that are very low cost. I mean, manganese is going to be what iron ore might be, $100 a ton or something. Manganese might be $3-4 per dry metric ton unit, which means if you're dealing with 37% manganese, multiply that by 37. That's your cost per ton. Mm-hmm. Now, that compares with copper, say, at $6,000, or nickel, rather more per ton. Whereas transportation is not likely to be a constraint with those base metals, transportation is really the whole story with iron ore and manganese.
Yeah.
If you're too far from a port, if there's no railway, if you're dependent on going by road, you're probably not going to be able to develop the acid. It's about ports and railways.
Yeah, there's a lot of quality assets in Australia that are stranded. I mean, forward a bit, but at one point, probably the iron ore asset that's in Jupiter Mines was considered stranded and uneconomic, wasn't it? That would be the case.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it very easily, because the obvious place to take that is, in fact, Esperance Port. But the Esperance Port is in the middle of the town, so it's a little constrained in volumes. And also the railway was semi-monopolized by one company, as were the tipplers in the port. So it was not easy to get stuff out. But yeah, I think that the expectation at that time, the reason for Red Rock being separated out, is because we thought we might get an offtake agreement or a partnership from, say, a Chinese company, which would mean that the trajectory towards production might be quite different and the whole company might be taken over by a partner. And so we thought, put it in a separate vehicle from Regency. Of course, the way things have turned out has been quite different, because Red Rock is now more of a gold stock than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, I mean, obviously you're no longer involved with Regency, but in Red Rock, the sort of constants, apart from you, been there since from day one, it's probably been the Kenyan gold asset and Jupiter Mines.
Day one was the iron ore and manganese assets. The manganese assets were in Western Australia. Yeah. And then manganese assets were explored. Yeah, they weren't really that good. The iron ore asset, Mount Ida, is a part of Jupiter. And, you know, when the iron ore price was last high at the beginning of the decade, Jupiter spent $40 million doing a feasibility on that. So it's a serious asset. Mm-hmm. It's got good metallurgical properties. Its problem is, of course, you know, because it's with a little bit of hematite, but mostly it's magnetite, and that means you're going to need water, you're going to need power, and of course, above all, you're going to need the transportation. And putting all that together when the iron ore price was high was one thing, but putting all that together when the iron ore price dropped suddenly to $20-something, you know, because this is what people forget about the commodity markets, is when oil is at $20-something, it seems impossible it should be over 100. When it's over 100, it seems impossible it should be back to 20. And yet these swings do occur, and they can happen quite quickly. Just as gold at $900, who'd have thought it would go down to 300? Then from 300, who can imagine it up at 1800? And so iron ore, the same thing. Iron ore was $140. Some of it trading at $180, came back to the 20s. Because, of course, the iron ore market has a dichotomy in it that I think exists also, for example, in gold, which is the biggest producers are incredibly low cost. They have finite resources, but they're not maximizing the benefit to themselves if they produce all those resources straight away, because the world's demand is such that the marginal ton or ounce is having to be produced at a much, much higher price. So on the one hand, you know, you can say, what is the, should the iron ore price be $25? Because the incremental demand theoretically could be met by BHP producing more, which only costs them that much per ton. Or should the iron ore price be $150? Because unless you've got $150 sustainably, no new production can come on stream, probably, even with infrastructure there. And if you have to build infrastructure as well, price probably has to be higher. So which is the right price? Well, ultimately, you know, you swing slightly between the two. Ultimately, the price has to be sufficient to justify new production coming on. Same thing with gold. The very big long-term gold assets that produce quite a bit of, you know, the world's gold, probably 30-40%, maybe more, are ultra-large, very low-cost producers. But they don't produce enough to meet the market. In theory, probably they could expand production if they really tried and fulfill most of market demand, and then the price would be much lower. But then they'd be running out quite quickly, and then the price would jump right up and they wouldn't have the benefit of it. So there's a kind of, is, should gold be the price at which the cheaper producers can increase their production, or should it be the price at which it's worthwhile people going and discovering more gold? Well, recently, it hasn't been worthwhile people going and discovering more gold. And there's going to be a shortage of gold production, as, because most gold mines are quite short life. Over the next 3 or 4 years, there's going to be a shortage unless a lot of work is done to increase supply, which is why I feel really quite positive about the gold price.
Right, so we'll probably, there's quite a few years between the inception of Red Rock and where we are now. And we could probably spend another hour talking about, you know, 12, 13, 14 years.
Yeah.
I think it's probably best if we just take a snapshot of what Red Rock has in its portfolio at the moment. Could you possibly give us just, you know, for the listeners that have not heard of Red Rock before, can you maybe give us an overview of the main core projects within Red Rock?
Yes. Red Rock's value proposition probably is that it only ever gets involved in things that it thinks can make mines. And therefore, it was involved in Colombia, bringing quite a rich mine back into production. And we're still getting some royalties from that. It's had its difficulties with expansion under the new ownership since we sold, but it's still there. Still batting away, we get something from that. We've obviously been there while the Chipi manganese mine has been brought on stream at Jupiter, which is the company into which we eventually put our iron ore and manganese assets, and where we're still shareholders. Very, very good dividend payer, with a yield between 10 and 20%, probably the world's cheapest, longest life producer of manganese. We have a resource that we believe in Kenya, the 1.2 million ounces, 1.3 grams, that we can believe can make a mine, because to the south of North Mara, to the north, where Shanta have come in, they have managed to up their grade by exploration considerably, got quite large resources, and we're just at the early stage of developing those resources. So we think, we, like other greenstone mines in the Tanzania and Craton, we think this can be a first-rate asset. We've also got some tailings there that could be brought into production much quicker, we hope. We have developed in the last few months a really significant new business in the Victoria Goldfields in Australia, and where we've just got a 43-101 done on that. We're planning to list it on the Toronto Stock Exchange. That's a joint venture with Power Metal Resources. And we have got assets in joint venture and in Congo, which are copper cobalt assets, but very rich, and some of them quite advanced, some of them exploration. Now, can we go to countries like Colombia, Kenya, Congo, because we think we can handle the problems there. And what we've proved in both Kenya, and I think people will soon see in Congo, is we can actually make the legal system work. We can make the law and contract count. And we do that by a mixture of quiet persistence, getting to know people, working there, taking time, and not giving up. And we got our Kenyan licenses back after several years. We think we can be one of the leading companies, make great progress in Congo. So we've got what we think are first-rate assets in Congo, worth much more than the company's value. We think we have mining assets in Kenya, which are worth much more than the company's value. And we think we will be able to list and sell our Australian assets for much more than the company's current value. And besides that, we are well-backed by an investment portfolio of getting on for £3 million.
Yep, and you just recently raised some money in the market.
Yeah, we raised some money in the market because having spent the last 2 or 3 years keeping very quiet as we resolved one or two family issues in our partners in Congo, and as we were in the latter stages of sorting things out in Kenya, where, remember, we actually took the government to court. We thought the right thing to do was to cut our costs and operate a very low cost base. Because, as I said, we promised people we're going to get Kenya back. Until we do that, nobody's really going to believe us. But when we do, things will be quite different. Well, we just have, and it was just at the right time because the gold price, of course, has been strengthening. So we have our work cut out. We have a lot to do, but we have a tremendous opportunity. And if you look at the last real gold bull market leading up to 2010, we performed exceptionally well. We outperformed. So we know how to do it. And having seen these things before, we should recognize the bull market when it comes. So, of course, we're still accompanied with a certain amount of risk because we have limited revenues and we're going to be spending more than our revenues. but we're a company that also has tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. I mean, obviously, you just recently announced an option in a Slovakian gold project as well that you seem to know quite a lot about.
Yeah, because, I owned those licenses in the early 2000s. We're doing due diligence on it. We'll have a look. There are three possibilities there. One, we decide that the due diligence might just be too hard. The other is we decide, as due diligence, that we quite like it. And the third is that we decide we quite like it, but we look at what's happening and beginning to happen elsewhere. And we think, we haven't got the bandwidth to do all of this. So even though it's good, we don't do it. So, we're going to look at this in a completely cold-blooded way, make the right decision. But while we've been doing the due diligence there, the progress in one or two other things, and I can't talk about that because we haven't announced it, progress in one or two other areas has been so spectacular that I just wonder whether we shouldn't focus more narrowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's another sort of element. Story quite well, Andrew, because obviously I was quite heavily invested back in the last time we got up to the, I think it was 100 million market cap you got to at one point.
Was that correct? It was more.
Was it more? Yeah.
It was more.
There's a royalty in the Mount Ida.
There is. Yes. And as I say, when the iron ore price is low, nobody can ever imagine it high. What we're trying to do at the moment is get Jupiter to spin out the iron ore assets because it's never going to invest in them. And that gives an opportunity to potentially develop those iron ore assets. You only need a good iron ore price for a short time in order to get off over the hump of investment. But if we could get that into production and it was producing iron ore, and there's no reason really why it shouldn't, because the main user of the Esperance port has stopped using it. They've run out of material. I think that would be, the royalty on that would be a very large income to us, a very large indeed, potentially. Now, you may say that's still just a dream, but it's with the iron ore price where it is now, it's much less of a dream than it was a few months ago. Things can change very quickly. And I remember back in the beginning of 2016, the manganese price was at lows, and we were the cheapest producer, and we were, okay, positive cash flow, but we were only doing that by using some material from stockpile and doing some quite judicious stuff. And we had a board meeting at the beginning of the year, and we were doing forecasts, looking at what major investment houses were forecasting for the manganese price. And we said, by the end of the year, we ought to be back at, what was it, $2.70 per DMTU from the current level of $1.40 or something. Or we should be $2.30 to $2.70 by the end of the year, we think, because we don't think it's sustainable down here. Well, we got on the planes and went home. Within a week or two, it already got there.
Oh, it's crazy, isn't it? That
yeah.
Was what, 100, yeah. Almost 100%, well, no, 70, 80% in a couple
yes,
of weeks.
Exactly. Yeah.
So just remind me, because I can't actually remember. So what is the percentage royalty you have over Mount Ida at the moment?
It was 1.5%. We sold part of it to a royalty company. Is it called Anglo-Pacific? I'm sorry. I've just forgotten the name. We sold, and they bought part of it outright. The rest they are obliged to buy on passing certain milestones. And so we would go down potentially to 0.75%, but collect $8 million. But that all depends on a project going ahead. Mm-hmm. Developing a project there is going to be, make no mistake, it's going to be an expensive business. It could be $1.8 billion or something.
Yeah, but obviously,
big project.
You've only got a royalty on the projects, so there's no need for Red Rock to get involved in that side of things.
No, exactly. My point in saying that is that the market doesn't have an infinite appetite for $2 billion projects. So there needs to be a real opportunity there, and there needs to be a player with deep enough pockets to do it. So if the iron ore price goes up enough, somebody may do that. There are a lot of steel mills that actually prefer to get magnetite rather than the hematite from the Pilbara. But you have to go over one or two hurdles of sorting out the infrastructure and the utilities and getting the initial investment done. But there's no reason to think that this couldn't happen in the next 3 or 4 years. It just would be unwise to bank on it at the moment. But so you keep one or two things like that in your back pocket on the view that one day they're going to happen.
Yep. Well, we'll watch this space. So just before we let Mark put you under the spotlight with the 60-second challenge, so just the market cap of Red Rock at the moment, I think it's £5.5 million.
With the money we just raised, that would be, I can tell you what it was likely to be. It should be about $6.9 million.
$6.9 million.
Just over seven.
Just over seven. So it's still, compared to some of the recent rises we've seen in the last couple of months, there's a lot of companies that are 4 and 5 times that market cap, with, you know, not the same level of assets that you guys have got.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is, Andrew? That you're probably not on the bandwagon the same as maybe some of the other companies? Is there any one reason you can put your finger on? No?
Everything has its moment. And what generally happens if something, I mean, there's an awful lot of undervalued companies in the market, as you know.
Yeah.
And the question of whether we're undervalued or not is, it's not 100% sure that we're undervalued. It just looks that way.
Yeah.
Suppose that we didn't manage to get things to work in Congo. Suppose that we weren't able to operate effectively and extract value in Kenya. Suppose that there were delays to our listing of the Australian assets. Then it's not quite so obvious that the value is there. In other words, still people can hypothesize. They can look at what's in the ground. They can look at all sorts of things, but you still have to do the work to make it happen. And doing the work in each country presents different challenges. So, what I'd say is the upside opportunity with us is very great. And we're going to aim to crystallize one or two of those opportunities. We're going to work very hard to try that. But it hasn't happened yet.
Yep.
Okay, now, at some point, people's hope will trump fear, and then it'll really move.
You'll probably find, I mean, my experience with these things is it's not an announcement. It does it. Sometimes it's just... I remember the first time, I think it was Regency when it went in a mad run. There was no announcement, there was nothing. I woke up one morning and looked at LSC and there was 340 posts overnight. And you just know instantly, because there's been so much chatter overnight, that it was just going to go on a massive run. And I think it done, that particular day, it done like 200 and some percent. I don't know what the catalyst for it was. It was like a tribal thing. I don't know. It was just bizarre. And there's quite a few examples of
that. And to some extent, it becomes self-fulfilling. Because if something moves like that, you can raise money on better terms. You can do deals on better terms. And you actually can get the company to move. But what we've been concentrating on is just putting the building blocks in place. And I think we've proved what we have in Kenya. If we prove what we've got in Congo, some of which is quite tangible, then it's quite possible that the price will move sooner than any of us expect.
Right, well, I'll watch this space. So, well, Mark, I've been talking too much, so I'm going to get you to put Andrew under the...
You know, I've got away with not talking about myself very much.
Well, I'm sure we can get you back on another time and we can... Yeah. No. I know you like to talk about politics, Andrew, and you had a bit of a political career as well, but like I say, we're trying to keep this to a manageable level, so we could maybe have
I mean, I think it would be pretty boring if every time I met people, I started talking about politics.
Yeah, so we've done well to keep politics out of it, so on that note, I'll pass it over to Mark.
Yeah, but before we do put you on the spot, Andrew, I wonder if I can just tap into your wealth of knowledge and experiences just a little bit. You've mentioned you've seen two cycles before, and you mentioned two metrics. You mentioned the metals and the commodities index. Is that right? You said earlier.
Well, I'm just thinking that if the metals index is starting to move up, it can be suggestive that the world economy is going to be growing faster than some people expect. Yeah. Secondly, it can be an indication that inflation could start to come back into the market.
Okay.
So I just keep an eye on indicators for these things.
And where do you find that? Because I've sort of Googled it and I can see there's the Bloomberg Commodity Index. What about what's the metals index that you look at then? I just wasn't sure what you looked at, that was all. Because it's like, I found the commodity index on Bloomberg. I didn't know if there was a precious metals or an industrial. There must be one of them somewhere.
Yeah.
Just so that I can have a look as well, that was all.
You can. What are you asking me for when you can look it up yourself?
Yeah, well, I did Google it, and I couldn't find a metals index. I'll do some more Googling, Andrew. I'll do some more Googling.
Right.
And what was the last sort of two cycles like? Are they really exciting sort of to be in? I've never been in one before, so I'm sort of looking forward to it. What can you entice me with to look forward to?
I think the great thing about when the cycle is moving in your favor is you begin to see all your judgments vindicated, and so you start to think you're very smart. And it feels good for a while. Of course, what then happens is that at the top of the market, you're in great danger of making mistakes and investing in things you shouldn't do. And the only thing that I can hope for us now is that we're not going to do that. Perhaps we did it last time. For example, top of the last cycle, we were spending a lot of money exploring for iron ore up in Greenland. Now, that was just opposite probably the world's highest grade iron ore deposit, Baffin Island, and which was at that point owned by the Mittals. And but you had all kinds of problems going over the permafrost on Baffin Island, But because we were in Greenland by the coast, and because you're clearer of ice over there on that side, we thought that there's a good chance of finding something, because the geology is the same. It's a continuation of finding something there. But although we managed to get just in 2 years an iron ore resource, that was magnetite. And finding the hematite, which is going to be less of and it's going to be more elusive, would have taken longer. Very expensive place to explore. And the cycle ran out on us. The iron ore price just went down very fast and went down a lot. So we had to write off all that expense. And our partners there spent a bit too much. You need a lot of helicopter support for what you were doing. So we could have been buried by that mistake. But it's the kind of, doing the things that a company like Mittal might do at the top of the market can be a temptation. But sometimes you have to know what you can control, and something where you're operating at the extremes in a very expensive environment, you're not going to find it easy to control risk and control price. So that was a lesson. I think the lesson from each cycle is not to make the same mistakes in the next cycle.
Yes.
And then you know what happens. Most of them do.
Yep. I think you got your answer there, Mark. So you did. So I think basically Andrew says he's not going to make the same mistakes this time round. I think if you get Redrock to £100 million, you'll retire, won't you? You'll sail into the sunset. Or is that not in your mindset?
I'm not a great retirer, because I think 60 is the new 40, but maybe some different combination of the stars will occur. We might sell out. We might sell our projects. There might be all kinds of things might happen. We might make so much money we will go off and do our own businesses. But the important thing is we've got to make that money for shareholders first by succeeding in the projects. And given that it seems I'm not particularly attracted by the thought of waiting around 20 years for the next big cycle to make money. I think we want to make money this time. We've got to get it right. So we've got to work extremely hard and try to get things right. That's what we're doing. And I'm really thrilled that with our Australian assets, we've got partnership with Power Metal Resources, because Paul Johnson, someone I've known a long time, who originally made money in Red Rock Resources, so I've known him for more than 10 years. And we've operated successfully in one or two companies. And we're a good mix of skills. And I think getting Australian assets floated off on a Canadian exchange is going to require quite a lot of different skills in the mix. And so for one person to be in charge of that would be difficult. I think having the two of us doing it and then bringing in other people and using our contacts, I think it makes it exciting and interesting. And I think it's going to be a great success.
Well, excellent. Watch this space. So, Mark, we'll let you go on with the 60-second challenge.
I'll pitch the 60-second challenge. Prior to that, I have just found a great website called tradingeconomics.com. There we go.
Okay.
And good. There's lots of things. And I can see a commodity index and an LME index, which is
excellent. Okay. So, and what's the LME index doing?
The LME index, so that's 2967.
Yep.
And what do you want, the commodity one as well? CRB?
No, I mean, how's the chart performing?
Oh, the chart, yeah, that's shot up, yeah.
Good.
Hit a low in sort of March time, just after March, maybe, middle of March, and it shot up. So it's actually gone a low in March of 2,300 to where it is now, basically just under 3,000 points.
And when you compare that with the All Commodities Index, you're not getting the same signal from the oil commodities index, are you?
I have to find the oil commodities index, but
right.
It will be on this website somewhere.
So this is my point, is that actually I think the signals for our sector in particular, if our sector is the mining sector, minerals, the signals are good.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, yeah.
It's gone from red to amber to green.
Yes, absolutely it has. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I found a crude oil chart here as well. Yeah, that doesn't look as pretty. But anyway, I'll have to dive through this. It's a good website, that I'm glad I found that today. That's something that will have to be on my bookmark, I think, for the future. Right, okay, yeah, let's get on with the 60-second challenge, Andrew. So you have 60 seconds in which to...
Right, so I have to get a timer now.
Yeah, if you get a timer, right. And I'll count you down from 3, 2, 1, yeah, and then you can pitch Red Rock. So in 3, 2, 1, off you go.
Red Rock is a company that is backed by substantial marketable assets, accounting for nearly 50% of its valuation, and which has projects, each one of which could be worth much more than the current market capitalization. They don't just have limited upside, they have huge upside. The first is the Australian Goldfields assets in Red Rock Australasia Limited. The second is the 1.2 million ounce resource Extendable in Kenya, and the third is our joint ventures in copper and cobalt in the Congo. Those three assets, above all, offer the potential for huge growth. We have a number of other assets in the portfolio, some of which are just waiting for the right time, but those three are the ones that in the near term, I predict could provide excitement for the market. And therefore, we're not a bad bet.
Fair enough. Good.
I did it.
You did? Yeah, you did. Good.
2 seconds to spare.
Excellent. We like that.
Yeah, I think the record's been over 3 minutes, Andrew, so the fact that you managed to keep it under a minute is great, because sometimes you lose track of time when you're under pressure.
When you're enjoying yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. But I think we're just probably just over the hour, so it's been great having you on, Andrew, and I'm sure we can get you back on and we can maybe delve into a bit of politics, and I know you like talking about the current COVID situation as well. I know you're quite vociferous in that, so that's something we could maybe
I'd be really annoyed if anyone starts trying to tell me to isolate, because I had this virus back in March and I didn't have any symptoms, but I had the antibodies to prove it because I got tested. And if I've got the antibodies, I just don't damn well see why anyone should be locking me down.
Especially when you've got a blubber 100 million market cap for your shareholders, Andrew. So no, I'm with you in that one. But no, it's been great having you on, and I can just now let you know that it's pitch black in Scotland. It's went from less than an hour, it's went from bright sunshine to total darkness. So
it's pitch black here, but I've got a nice golden moon I can see.
Yes. Well, it gets dark now. We're by September, beginning of October. It gets dark almost the same time. I mean, in Kenya, I think it gets dark about 6 or 6:30 every night.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite quick.
Yeah, so, it happens quickly as well, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I remember I was in Jamaica and I'm going off piste, and I remember going for a shower and it was like broad sunshine, you know, great. And then I come out after the shower and it was like dark. You know, it's just went just almost like 10 minutes. It was really bizarre. But there we go. Right, good stuff. On that note, we'll let you get back to your work, Andrew, because I know you're a busy man. And thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
thanks.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.